Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Ben Pink Dandelion, and I look after the work of the Centre for Postgraduate Quaker Studies. And I'd like to welcome you to one of our four free open talks that we're holding this year. Very pleased to welcome Geoffrey Plank, who's Professor of American Studies at the University of East Anglia, coming reasonably freshly from Cincinnati, where he was for about 16 years before. He's recently authored John Woolman's Path to the Peaceable Kingdom, A Quaker in the British Empire, and is also working with Britton Carey on an edited collection from the Quakers and Anti-Slavery Conference that they organised in Philadelphia a couple of years ago. This is the start of a seven-talk series, and I've been told on good authority it's the only talk that Geoff's giving of that series in Britain in 2012. So very pleased to have you with us. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, the talk I'm giving today is based on the research I did for this book and on John Woolman, and writing the book, and also in, this is the first of these talks I'm giving on the book, there's a basic problem that I had to confront, which is that in the wider world, most people have never heard of John Woolman, and then with Quakers, he is one of the most familiar figures out there. I want to start by just asking for a show of hands of how many people know John Woolman. Okay, so it's just about everybody in the room. So bear with me for the first paragraph, because you probably are already familiar with all of this. But the New Jersey Quaker John Woolman is well known as a leading opponent of slavery within the Society of Friends. In 1754, he produced the first anti-slavery essay approved for publication by the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. In 1758, he argued within that meeting for an official statement disapproving of slaveholding. He traveled extensively in the South and New England and in the vicinity of Philadelphia, visiting slaveholders and pleading with them to free their slaves. Eventually, he took his anti-slavery message across the Atlantic to England. He asked Quakers and others to assess their subtle complicity in the economy of slavery and suggested that the only just course of action would be to refuse any product or service derived from slave labor. In an effort to symbolically detach himself from the evils of the Atlantic economy, he behaved in an increasingly peculiar manner, refusing sugar like other abolitionists, but also avoiding dyed cloth and riding in rides in English carriages. After his death, he was revered as a Quaker saint, and he continues to be celebrated in those kinds of terms by many Quakers today. He has also been long remembered, a little inaccurately, as the founder of Quaker abolitionism. My talk is based on my research, as I said, conducted for my book on Woolman. And as the title of the book suggests, John Woolman's Path to the Peaceable Kingdom, it covers more than just a woman's agitation against slavery. But slavery will be my focus today, and I'm particularly interested in Woolman's personal experience and how his interactions with slaves and former slaves informed the details of his agitation against slavery. Got some pictures here. Now, one of the things that I tried to do, one of the things I tried to do with this book is move beyond the, I mean, obviously you need to use John Woolman's journal as a source, but to use other sources of information, other things that he wrote. And this picture is a picture of one of his ledgers for his work as a estate manager, basically running through the estate inventories of people who had died. And I used this source, and I'll come back to it in a minute. But now let me get on to talk about the importance of this work for Woolman's anti-slavery message. Woolman was one of many abolitionists in his era, but he approached the problem of slavery from an unusual perspective as an expert on the disposition of estates. All of his written statements against slavery were informed in part by his experience as a will writer and testator and his concerns over the disposition of property between generations. To give a dramatic example of how will writing affected his thinking, in the 1760s, he tried to calculate the debt that might be owed to the heirs of a hypothetical male slave who had been violently taken from Guinea at the age of 40 and labored till old age. If the man's labor had been worth 50 pounds, his heirs would deserve that sum with interest. Adding 3% annual interest and compounding every 10 years, Woolman calculated that on the enslaved man's death, his children should receive £141. Woolman was good with numbers. He had a fine eye for detail, and he knew how to write legal documents. Even as a young man, he was a leading figure in his community in part because of his literacy, and specifically as a consequence of his ability to draft wills and bills of sale. It was this skill which forced him early in his career to wrestle with the disposition of slaves. The first of these episodes is perhaps the best remembered. In 1742, when he was 22 years old and working in a shop, his master approached him and asked him for assistance in the sale of a woman. The purchaser was waiting outside. Woolman felt uneasy but acquiesced in the request. He felt obliged to do so under the terms of his own labor contract, and he partially consoled himself with the thought that the woman was going to a good home. He knew and respected the purchaser, someone he later described as an elderly man and a member of our society. Still, the act of writing the bill of sale disturbed Woolman, and he could not keep his silence. "I was so afflicted in my mind that I had before my master that I said before my master and the friends that I believe slave keeping to be a practice inconsistent with the Christian religion." In Woolman's account of his career, this was his first step towards active campaigning against slavery. During the 1740s and early 1750s, Woolman had several encounters with neighbors who came to him asking for assistance in writing their wills. In his conversation with slave owners, he acknowledged that some masters held slaves with good intentions, with no other motives than the Negro's good. But such people were deluded, he warned, if they thought that they could act as guardians for their slaves' interests and bequeath them to the next generation. No father has any assurance that his children will attain to that perfection and wisdom and goodness necessary in an absolute governor. Testators who left their slaves to their offspring exposed the enslaved to the risk of abuse. Woolman records three episodes from the late 1740s and early 1750s involving slaveholders who wanted him to write their wills. In all of these instances, he refused to do the work requested unless the wills were altered to specify that the testator's slaves would be freed upon the testator's death. The first time Woolman made this declaration, the man who came to him left in silence, but the later two encounters had better outcomes. With friendly talk and serious conference, he secured the slave's eventual freedom. On the basis of these conversations and other experiences, Woolman came to believe that all people were born with a natural desire of superiority, and that this evil impulse often revealed itself as a perverse kind of parental concern for the next generation. As a will drafter, he saw firsthand how a view to get riches and provide estates for children entangled many parents in what he called the spirit of oppression. Woolman warned Quaker parents, not only when they wrote their wills, but more generally in the conduct of their lives, that their ambitions might do sensible harm to themselves and also harm their children. Ambitious parents taught their children to be greedy, and slaveholding parents risked doing even greater harm. Woolman argued that parents corrupted their sons and daughters by encouraging them to rely on the labor of slaves. The children of slave masters often grew accustomed to fullness, ease, and idleness, and became arrogant by lording it over their fellow creatures and being masters of men in their childhood. Woolman was particularly critical, harshly critical, of the slave masters of the South and the damage they were doing to future generations. He was gentler in his discussion of Quaker slave masters in the Philadelphia area, but he was equally direct in the way he warned them that they were doing their heirs spiritual harm by bequeathing them slaves. Woolman consistently framed the problem of slavery within family dynamics, and he warned slaveholders that the salvation of their children and grandchildren was at risk. Now, one thing Woolman never said, at least never in print, was that he was the son of a grandson of a slave master, and that throughout his life, his own family was wrestling in intimate ways with the legacy of that slaveholding experience. In the early 1740s, Woolman served as a witness when his grandfather Henry Burr made his will. The beneficiaries included someone without a last name whom Burr identified as my Negro woman, Maria. Maria was 50 years old, and Burr had held her in slavery for many years. Township records indicate that she was living in his house as a slave in 1709. Sometime before he wrote his will, Burr had formally granted Maria her freedom. And in his will, he left her provisions and equipment that he believed she might need as she started a newly independent life. He bequeathed her a spinning wheel for linen, another for wool, an iron kettle, a pot, and the bed whereon she generally lodges, with the bedstead and furniture thereunto belonging. He left her a cow, a flock of chickens, and all the provisions that is left in the house, both the eatables and the drink, which in the end included wheat, flour, cheese, pork, molasses, and rum. Although Woman does not mention Maria in his journal, she was part of the life of his family, both when she was a slave and after she was legally released. She was probably in the room when Woman's sister Elizabeth died. On the day after Elizabeth's death, acting as in his role as executor, John paid Maria 18 shillings and ninepence. Over the next decade, Maria worked as a weaver and lived with a man named Tony. I'm going to show you, and this is actually a page from the book you were just looking at, involving the Negro Maria, as a woman calls her, her estate inventory. And this is one of the few documents that I was able to use to get Maria's story. And one of the difficulties with the story of all of these enslaved people and freed people is that none of them have last names. And so there is a problem of tying it together and a little bit of inference in figuring out what the family relations are. As best as I can tell, actually this I know for sure, Maria had two children, and they appear in fleeting references in the testamentary documents, that they were two daughters, one named Isabella and the other sharing her mother's name, Maria. At the time of the older Maria's death in 1760, Isabella was living with John's mother, and during the 1760s, both sisters would move into his brother Asher's house. And I've got a picture of Asher's house. In 1771, Woman's brother Abner acknowledged these women's service to his extended family by remembering them in his will. Similarly, in 1772, when John's mother died, when she drafted her will, she made bequests to Negro Isabel and her sister Maria, who lived with me. John Woman died without writing a will, and so we have no record of any bequests he might have given to Maria and her family. His brother Abner, however, not only made such a bequest, but also discussed in general terms how slaveholding created a lasting debt. In 1768, Abner wrote, "I became settled in my mind that if those whose estates were advanced by the labor of slaves would give up freely to have their cases examined, it would be pleasing to Providence and add to their happiness even in this life to have equity put in practice." Abner added, "At this present time, there is Negroes amongst us who have monies justly due them from members of our monthly meeting." We know from John Woman's journal that in the abstract, in general terms, he agreed with Abner, but he does not mention Maria and her daughters in his journal, and this silence raises a big question. Given the journal's confessional tone and Woman's statements of concern for the debts he owed slaves, why did he say nothing about Maria and her family? In one passage, he declares in passionate terms that he had a debt to repay the sugar-producing slaves of the Caribbean, and he goes so far as to consider hiring an empty ship and sailing down the Atlantic to Barbados to see them. If he's willing to do that for the slaves of the Caribbean, why isn't there a word about Maria? Silences are difficult to interpret, but I can offer at least a possible explanation for Woman's decision not to tell Maria's story. Quaker journals like Woman's were public documents, and they were written with contemporary readers in mind. There are signs of this all over Woman's journal. For example, wherever he makes a shorthand reference to people and events that are now long forgotten, names whose significance has become for us obscure. Woman's intended readers, his contemporaries, would have been able to fill in the details. Furthermore, Quaker journals were not intended to sow discord, settle accounts, or score points between Quakers, or settle disputes, score points in disputes between Quakers. For this reason, Woman conceals the names of Quaker slaveholders throughout his text. he describes that instance from 1742 in great detail, for example, but identifies the purchaser only as an elderly man and a member of our society. In the context of the journal, he did not want to name and shame anyone, and it's impossible to imagine how he could have mentioned his own family's history of slaveholding without basically identifying specific slaveholders, which is something he doesn't do anywhere in the journal. Since we do not have Woolman's account of his feelings for Maria and her daughters, is there any way we can determine whether he felt guilty about the way they were treated by his family, either as slaves or after they secured freedom? There are clues, to be sure, in his general statements about the corrupting influence that older generations of slaveholders could have on their offspring. But I think the best indication we have of Woolman's ambivalent feelings comes from his relationship with another enslaved family, the children of a man named Tabby, who is legally bound to a wealthy Quaker in Mount Holly, New Jersey, Woolman's hometown, named Thomas Shinn. In 1697, when Thomas Shinn was 2 years old and Tabby was not much older, Tabby had been delivered in trust for Shinn's use as a slave. 54 years later, in 1751, Tabby was married and both he and his wife were working for Shinn as slaves. Shinn additionally held four younger persons enslaved in his household, and these are almost certainly the couple's children. Three girls named Hannah, Jade, and Pleasant, and a boy named Jem. In 1743, Shinn had served as a witness alongside John Woolman when Woolman's grandfather, Henry Burr, made his will, announcing that Maria would be free and granting her some modest means for subsistence. Therefore, we can assume that Shinn was aware that some Quakers were uneasy or felt uneasy about keeping slaves and their offspring in bondage across generations. In his own will, Shinn directed that Tabby and his wife should be freed immediately after my decease, and he left them £5 worth of goods, but he was not willing to liberate the children so quickly. New Jersey law stipulated that anyone who freed a slave had to post a bond to support that person in the event of hardship, to make sure that no former slaves could ever claim poor relief. Shinn did not want to saddle his heirs with this obligation, and so he raised some of the necessary bond money by selling Hannah as a servant with a fixed term of service. To compensate his daughters for the liability they were assuming, he gave Jade as a bound servant to one of his daughters and Pleasant as to another of his daughters. Under the terms of these arrangements, all three young women would be freed when they reached the age of 30. Shinn retained Jem, who was only 6 years old in 1751, but he directed the executors of his estate to sell the boy after Shinn's death in the same way that Hannah had been sold, with the proceeds returned to the estate. Okay, that sounded a little bit convoluted. I'm going to show you the actual text in the will. This is probably Woolman's handwriting. But basically, there are four children involved. All of them are being held in bondage until the age of 30, and I'll have more to say about their specific circumstances in just a second. We can learn a great deal by looking at this episode in detail. The first thing to notice is the similarity between the Shinn's family history and that of the Woolmans. Both were associated with an enslaved family across generations from the early 18th century or earlier, at least through the 1770s. In both cases, granting freedom to the enslaved did not entail severing contact with the children. Maria's two daughters continued to live with the Woolmans and work for them even after they were freed. Tabby's children were tied to the Shinn family even more closely, perhaps because they were younger than Maria and Isabel. In any event, Tabby's two daughters, Jade and Pleasant, were assigned without their formal consent to bound contracts to work for Shinn's daughters until they reached the age of 30. Another thing that jumps out at you looking at this story, if you're familiar with the journal and subsequent work that's been done on it, is that Woolman expresses regret in his journal for what happened to Jem. He doesn't actually name Jem, though it's clear that's who he's referring to. He expresses real, almost agony about what happened to Jem being held in bondage till the age of 30. but says absolutely nothing about Hannah, Jade, or Pleasant. There are several possible distinguishing features that may make the fate of the three women different from the fate of the men. The first, fairly obviously, though I don't think it's really the critical distinction, is that they were women and Jem was male. I actually put that out there as a possibility, but it's not one that I think is operating here. Another thing that is possibly relevant is that Jade and Pleasant were kept within the Shin family, and Woman was very close to that family, and he trusted them. But his commentary suggests that that should not have made too much of a difference. As I've said, you know, earlier quoting Woman, he did not believe that you could trust families for long, I mean, as you go through generations. And so the fact that they were held by the Shins should not have made the critical difference. I think the real critical difference, as far as Woman's expression of regret is concerned, is that he did not have his fingerprints on the documents that bound out Jade and Pleasant. This actually gets fairly technical, because he wrote this will that it says, and I have done this, or and this is happening, but the will is not the instrument that actually makes it happen. They were disposed of outside the will. They were sold at the moment that the will was made, but the will doesn't do the job. So Woman was not as directly responsible for what happened to Hannah, Jade, and Pleasant. And this is another document. This is actually after Shin dies, so it's 3 or 4 years later when they're actually disposing of the property. This is actually the last item on the state inventory. This actually is a very kind of evocative document for me. I got it out of the New Jersey State Archives, you know, just asking for wills, and it is clearly John Woolman's handwriting. You know, and I'd seen John Woolman's handwriting in a lot of spiritual documents, and to see it here was actually quite something. But it is interesting. It's the last item on the inventory. Here is Jem being sold for £20, and it's also interesting, if you didn't notice, the size of the estate. It's a over £1,800, which is a huge amount of money in New Jersey at this time. So, as I said, something you want to take away from this is that Woman, and it's part of his larger project of anti-slavery, that's actually not in the text, but I want to mention that he wanted people to be specific, to be careful about what they were responsible, and to pay back for their own responsibility. And so in that logic, it makes perfect sense that Jem would be the person, rather than Hannah, Jade, or Pleasant, that he would be paying attention to. And I do want you also to notice the specifics of what Woman did in acknowledgement of his debt to Jem. He decided to compensate Jem for one half of the extra time that Jem had been required to serve. It was only going to be one half because there were two executors to the estate. And John Woolman said, well, I'm only responsible for half of what's owed. And so he cut that extra 9 years of service to 4.5 and said, I will pay you 4.5 when you reach the age of 30. He made a bond to make that payment. And then it's also important, and I'll be going a bit on about this, that it's only 9 extra years of service that he is paying Jem for, because he thought keeping Jem in bondage till the age of 21 was all right. Why was it all right to keep someone in bondage without their consent, with no contract, until the age of 21? Because white children could be bound to service until the age of 21, and it routinely happened. So this is important. Woman didn't think there was any gross injustice in children being held in bondage without their consent until the age of 21. The comparison with white children, I think, needs just a little bit more attention. It was, as I said, normal for some children, anyway, to be bound out against their will until the age of 21 in the 18th century. But it happened only under one of two circumstances. Either their parents entered into contracts to send their children away, or the local authorities, believing that the parents couldn't support the children anymore, would basically intervene and make such an arrangement. And this was considered a form of poor relief, basically. You would take poor children away from the families that couldn't support them, send them somewhere else. In this case, Tabby, Jem's father, was not a partner to the arrangements. Legally, we know he wasn't, and it's unlikely that he had much sway over the contracting partners. Not just because we know he had little bargaining power, but also because Woman spells out both in his journal and in the text of the will what the principal concerns of the contracting parties were, which was to compensate the owners for the legal expense or potential liabilities entailed in effecting emancipation. So it was Shin and his executors who were making the decision. In effect, if we're going to take the comparison with white children seriously, they were stepping in and playing the part of the parent or the local authority in determining Jem's fate. What this all comes down to is that in the case of Tabby's children, the masters did not simply let them go. There was a transitional period, 20 years in Tabby's case, in which the master continued to act as a guardian for the former slave, and the former slave continued to owe service to the former master or his assign if the master-slave relationship was sold to a third party. And in Jem's case, Woman accepted the propriety of the first 11 years of service. He only objected to the last 9. I'm repeating myself a little bit. It is interesting to compare this situation to what happened routinely to white children, but there's another important comparison to make, and it's one that Woman could not have made because he was writing in 1771, 1772, and died in 1772. But the prescription of a just outcome in Jem's case, Woman's prescription of a just outcome in Jem's case, closely tracks the gradual emancipation program that Woman's fellow Quaker abolitionists like Anthony Benezet championed in colonies in states like Pennsylvania. Now, here I'm going to get into the scholarship and why this is important, and it's something I want to work further on. Professional historians and Quakers, and I don't mean to put those as completely separate categories, it kind of confuses me if you do, but professional historians and Quakers in general have long found it difficult to see eye to eye concerning the emancipation program championed by Benezet and other revolutionary era Quakers. In his recent Bancroft-winning History of Labor Systems in North America, Christopher Tomlins has declared that those who celebrate the abolitionists of John Woolman's generation do history no favors. Quakers, on the other hand, have long celebrated Woolman and his colleagues, and they have done so in part by looking away from the problems that disturb historians like Tomlins. The celebratory literature on Quaker abolitionism tends to sidestep the limitations of gradualism. The gradual emancipation program left slavery intact in those places where it was most entrenched, in the South in particular. In effect, gradual abolitionism divided the continent more sharply than it had been before, and in the long run, made Southern slaveholders more defensive, contributing ultimately to the violence of the Civil War. Even in the North, gradual abolition left many slaves, like Jem, serving long years of continuing bondage. So perhaps Tomlins is right. Perhaps there is nothing there really to celebrate. But perhaps celebrating is not what we should be doing in relation to Woolman in the first place. If we confront the gradualist nature of his response to slavery from our perspective, looking back from a vantage point of 250 years, our first project probably should be to try to understand him. And this brings me back, at least for illustrative purposes, to Maria and Isabel. Woolman was keenly aware of the burden of past events. In his celebrated essay, A Plea for the Poor, he wrote, "By the agreements and contracts of our fathers and predecessors, and by doings and proceedings of our own, some claim a much greater share of this world than others. And whilst those possessions are faithfully improved for the good of the whole, it consists with equity." In short, he was saying it was fine to be rich, just so long as you cared for your neighbors and lived as a Christian should. Not only should the rich use their material resources well, they should also be conscious of their exalted reputation, expect emulation, and set an example of good behavior for the lowly. Woolman knew he was living in an imperfect world, and all of this is premised on that those earlier injustices or earlier events, and actually they're not all injustices, but the way things sorted out that put some people in positions of wealth and power in relations to others. But in that context, his vision of social harmony was hierarchical. He believed that because of our histories, we live in a hierarchical world and we must make that world good. And with respect to slavery, he assumes the persistence of hierarchy in the short to medium term. And he argued that that inequality should be used for the benefit of all. For example, and I'm now talking not just about Woolman, but also about Benezet and his generation of Quaker abolitionists. For example, by providing education for the freed slaves, and in Woolman's case, pushing hard for compensation for freed slaves, or at least in his writings, suggesting that the compensation should be made. And perhaps, and this is entirely speculative, on a personal level, and here I guess I would refer more to Abner than to John, keeping slaves or providing for slaves within your own family. We are not called upon now to endorse or reject that project. It belonged peculiarly to Woolman's era. Now, I guess, and this is the sort of last page, but the things I'm saying now I think would be great to sort of jumping off for discussion. But our distance from the social world that Woolman inhabited allows us to ask different questions, and specifically in a different way to consider how Woolman's project might have appeared to slaves. There is good evidence that many slaves and former slaves were skeptical of the Quakers' gradual emancipation program. It's impossible to read Woolman's account of Jem's case without sensing that Jem was unhappy in his continuing servitude. And if those of you who are familiar with his journal, Woolman describes himself sitting in what he calls the uppermost seat of the meeting house and looking across and seeing Jem worshiping on the other side of the meeting house and feeling intensely uncomfortable with the situation. And you know, it begs for you to ask, where does that sense of discomfort come from? Obviously, it could come from many things, but I think maybe Jem himself may have telegraphed some feeling in that context. Benevolence looks different when viewed from below. And the last little episode I'm going to mention, I'm just very briefly going to tell the story. And again, it depends partly on how you read the text that's come down to us. But William Bone was another slave held by a Quaker master near John Woolman's house. John Woolman knew William Bone well. One day in the early 1760s, Bone was walking along his master. As he remembered years later, he was going to my work, and his master turned to him and asked him, "William, wouldn't thee like to be free?" Now, the way I read Bone's memory of this conversation, the way he recalled it later, there's an element of contempt in William Bone's response. He remembered, and this is what he said in the 1820s when this was written down, "I didn't say anything to it. I thought he might know I should like to be free." Okay. So that's it.
So we have time for comments or questions. Yes.
One of the questions that I've had about Jem and being anxious about Jem was it a case that Woolman didn't know to whom he might be sold and then sold on? Because in the case of the daughters, they were likely to stay with the family with whom everyone was familiar and they were older anyway. Mm-hmm. But Jem was a child who was vulnerable and if sold on once or twice, might move out of that community. And that was indeed into all sorts of unpleasant situations. And was that also probably, I've always thought of, as one of the reasons why one has to be anguished about that? Because there's no sort of benevolent parental feeling about that. It is scary.
I think you're right. I think in the personal dynamics of it, the fact that Jem is only 11 when the sale takes place, or 10 or 11, is definitely would make it seem more painful. Two things that crossed my mind. Hannah is one of the... I mean, I went back to this and looked at the two or three times, because Hannah is also sold to just anybody. I mean, the purchaser is not identified. And so Hannah is actually sold out of the family.
I think you're probably right that the fact that she's older may make that seem less painful. But then the other thing that occurs to me is, just thinking about this, is the comparison with white children bound to service. They were also being sent away from the family. And Woolman explicitly says that, you know, if we treat Jem the way we treat white children, she's not making any sort of moral declaration. This is the way it always should be. But the injustice comes from that distinction. And if Jem had been 10 years old and a white child in a family that couldn't support him, I mean, Woolman's not making any statement in this context that it would have been wrong to sell him to a stranger. So I guess there are different ways. You can look at this as sort of a implicit policy statement, which I think Woolman asks you to do in his journal. I think he's clearly trying to set an example for how other people should respond in these situations. But there's also an emotional level or a personal dynamics level that I think you're right. And I think that moment in the meeting house he describes, knowing Jem's personal history and being face to face with Jem. I mean, there's all sorts of things we would be wonderful to try and know. About who owned Jem? And, you know, what actually did happen to him after he was sold? And you know, we don't have hints of that at this point.
I realize context is everything, but it seems to me, you know, a moral act is one, it can't be one done with a hope of reward. And it seems to me that the almost forensic way in which he approaches this, you're tempted to wonder whether his concern is with the well-being of the slaves or of his own soul. And he is buying, you know, it suggests he feels to be buying his own salvation and limiting himself to what he needs to do in order to achieve that in his own mind, rather than having a wider concern for the well-being of the slaves.
I think, you know, this, in my mind, I'm not sure I completely agree with you in the long run, but I think in my mind this is related to what I was saying about that the world as we have it now is hierarchical. And one of the things he assumed, and I think all of the Quaker abolitionists of his generation assumed, was that the power to change the system belonged entirely to white people. There's a nice Joshua Evans's journal. He describes going to Quaker slave masters to argue for freeing the slaves, and they very carefully get the slaves out of the room and keep it a complete secret from them that this discussion is taking place. There was an idea that it was dangerous and inappropriate to involve black people in the conversation, the way I look at what Woolman's doing and paying only half the compensation, I think you're right. He's worried about his own complicity. But I think he's doing that because he wants other white people to worry about their own complicity. And his whole model for changing it is going to be when everybody else does exactly what he does. So I guess what I would say is the reason he's not paying up all of the debt is because this is the way I read it. That's not a formula for changing the world. That's Woolman being good. And oh, isn't that nice? And he solved that problem. We can get on with things. It lets all his white neighbors off the hook too easily. And if he actually says, well, I will only do my share, then he's basically throwing it. And actually, we do know, there's a man named Henry Paxson was the other executor. I wish I knew how Henry Paxson responded, but it seems to me that only paying his share is really slapping the face of other people who have their own debts that have been left unpaid. That's the way I look. Like I say, one of the things about this is that, you know, there are things that are just sort of stunningly brilliant about John Woolman, and there are other things that are actually just not like us. And that absolute assumption that slavery will end
because of what white people do, I think runs straight through. And it's not the way we look at the world. It's not the kind of social program that we would want to emulate. But there are other parts of the program that, that obviously are, worthy of emulating. But that's not the point. I guess the point is that John Woolman lived then and we live now.
I was wondering how much do we know about John Woolman's views on the education of slaves and on freed slaves, and particular in relation to other groups at the time. You mentioned white children in bondage, mm-hmm. up to the age of 21. I'm sorry, I can't remember, but does he have much to say on the subject of education, and particularly on literacy?
He does, when he's criticizing slavery in the South, make a point that they haven't educated their slaves. And in Woolman's account books, it's clear he's lending, it's a strange book, but he lends Barclay's apology to somebody he identifies that I can't remember. It's Negro William or something, Negro somebody. I'm sorry, that's the way it appears in the account books. So I feel fairly confident that he's doing that on a sort of personal level. And in both contexts, the education is meant to Christianize. And he definitely has a model in the long run. And I guess that's something else to sort of fold into the equation, that I was saying that the world is hierarchical and the world we live in is hierarchical, but he has a goal which is universal and would in the end break down all of these boundaries. But then the other moments, you mentioned other groups, Woolman's writing and his approach to Native Americans is equally interesting. And I write about this in the book as well, with Native Americans, partly because of the visit of this man, Poppin' Hank, to Philadelphia, a Delaware prophet. The Quakers in the early 1760s were sort of stunned by Poppin' Hank's apparent spirituality and came to believe very strongly that God had intervened in their lives and that they were independently finding truth. And so Woolman and other Quakers at the time were wondering, well, should we go and see them or should we not? And part of the issue there was, it's playing out by itself. God is directly in their lives. And ultimately, that becomes part of the Quaker ideology of missionary work towards Native Americans, that they have their own source. And so, in a way... and again, that can cut both ways, because actually in the late 1760s, the Quakers pull back from intervention in Indian affairs probably much too much. They're interesting debate. Actually, in a way, they're equally complicated in very different sets of debates about education with Native Americans. I was going to say, the person who really... rightly is celebrated for advocating education for freed slaves is Anthony Benezet, and the two, Woolman and Benezet, are very different people in their approach to all sorts of things.
Do you think Woolman and his fellow Quakers saw Negroes, slaves, mm-hmm. and Native Americans as two completely distinct groups and responded differently, one being enslaved and the other not? Do you think that was the difference that they defined?
They almost completely uncritically, I think, assumed that they were different groups, if you mean, were they aware? Did they talk about African Americans moving into Native American communities or anything like that? I've never seen any reference to anything like that.
I meant, did they view the two groups as completely separate?
Uh-huh.
Morally and spiritually. one...
You know, it's interesting because they do get discussed. Woolman discusses them in very different ways. And there is, I mean, and I think that does reflect the sense of Native Americans retaining independence and also a sort of sense of responsibility for their own futures. And that doesn't mean, and one thing Woolman doesn't do is sort of create a noble savage image or anything like that. He has a, you know, on his way to visit Poppenhank, he sees these carvings or paintings on the sides of trees, and he starts to talk about, I mean, they're apparently warrior pictures, how the Native Americans have been raising up their children to fight, and actually his whole commentary there, and he does blame white people for a lot of the problems that Native Americans have, but he also does, and actually this is related to the education point, say that Native American children have been raised badly by the example of their parents because of the violence of Native American societies and so on. He doesn't have occasion, really, to talk about African Americans in that, or certainly not in the journal. He doesn't get into the internal dynamics of
Because really what he's talking about is responsibility to the slave community, almost a parental responsibility for their well-being and and futures. Of course there isn't any for the other group. There's not that sense of responsibility.
There is. I mean, because, you know, again, it's all in that part of the journal, but there, he has this, you know, really stunning, very brief visionary moment where he says he's standing on a hill, you know, in the foothills of the Appalachians, and he says he sees the whole continent of North America before him, and he says, you know, that the fertile plains of the Atlantic now belong to the white people. He's very ambivalent about that. I mean, he sort of mostly is with the founding myth of Pennsylvania. He thinks at least his ancestors were kindly welcomed, and, you know, and the Indians eventually went away. But he's certainly aware of the violence and the dispossession and of the hardship that Native Americans faced by being pushed west. You know, and it's almost a matter of, you know, this is you know, historian, you know, picking on silly detail, but his analysis is about altitude. It's not about east west, but it's, you know, that they've been kicked out of the low fertile area and now they have to suffer living in the hills, which is less fertile and less abundant and so forth. So he is aware of a kind of responsibility, but it's a responsibility, you know, for the hardships Native Americans have. But it's a very mixed sense of responsibility, because in a way it's a favor that God has given the Quakers, that they now have the nice land on the coast.
Thank you. Very interesting.
I wondered if you had any clues why he's softer on the Philadelphia slave masters than those in the South. Is it that they're doing more for the enslaved?
Well, this is another one where, you know, it's tempting to psychoanalyze. You know, throughout. Even when he's in the South, he makes distinctions between slave masters, and that's kind of startling when you notice it. But even, you know, in Virginia, he talks about how he didn't like it when he lived with, you know, slave masters who didn't do any work. And the implication is that if he was in a household where the slave master was out in the fields all day, he wouldn't feel so bad. And you know, in his discussion with in those early episodes with people with writing their wills, he makes a point of telling them, you can be a good slave master. That's fine. That's part of the premise of his discussion. And so I do think that he drew distinctions. Actually, there's another dramatic passage in the journal where he says he crossed from Pennsylvania to Maryland, and he doesn't quite put it in these languages. I can't remember the exact words, but he basically says, and I crossed the border and I felt sick. You know, that he really has the sense that there's a huge division between Pennsylvania and Maryland, and when he gets to Maryland, and then he's in bad country. And I think, you know, it's easy for us, you know, since the Civil War and everything, to see that as, basically assigning slavery to the South and thinking it didn't exist in Pennsylvania. And that's, obviously, this is another point I'm sort of spinning off, but it's another point where Woolman's readers would have known there was slavery in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, so that when we read that, it seems slightly different than it would have to Woolman's readers. So I guess it may be that he's being polite to Quakers, but I think it's also that he actually thought the Quakers were better masters. Actually, it's explicit. He does think that Quakers are better masters than some.
Any more? Well, Jeff will be around for a bit of staying overnight, mm-hmm. so you can catch him at the end of this evening or at breakfast. Mm-hmm. And do buy the book. And let us thank Jeff very much. Yeah.